So last week we looked at 2 Chronicles chapter 15. And my goal today is to finish chapter 16, but that's not where I'm going to start. I've been promising for a couple of weeks now to make some comments about the relevance of the actions of Asa and of other godly kings to our own day in the realm of the civil magistrate. And to remind you a little bit of what the context I'd like at least for us to think of this in, I encourage you to turn to 2 Chronicles 15, which we looked at, as I said, last week, and especially verse 12, in the time of, really at the height of the Reformation, which Asa led, as the Spirit of God enabled him. It says in 2 Chronicles 15:12, "Then they entered into a covenant to seek the Lord God of their fathers with all their heart and with all their soul." And then, of course, there's more description of that in the context. But that basic idea of they're seeking the Lord together as a people, and as I pointed out last time, this isn't, of course, only a personal matter. This is a national matter, and it had to do with the relationship of the ruler, in this case Asa, to serve God as well. And in that context, then, I'd like to think a little bit about what we've been talking about has to do with rulers in our day. And, you know, we've looked at Asa going around smashing icons, and they were corrupt images used in idolatrous practices and so forth. And, of course, our first reaction may be, obviously, this has nothing to do with anything that could go on today. In other words, when we tend to think of violations, say, of the first and second commandments, we may tend to think in different terms and not realize that many of those issues are still around today. So I thought I'd just mention a couple. One issue that's come up in the military chaplaincy is what is allowable as a chaplain. And, you know, in a nation like ours, you would expect to have a variety of Christian denominations represented. But, of course, there are also Buddhist chaplains now. And there is even an instance of at a military base, a service being led by Wiccans. Wiccans are representatives of what they call the old earth religion. The impolite name is witches. And that's an example of the extent to which toleration is extended. And I think you can see the relevance directly to the first commandment. In what sense does a civil magistrate have any responsibility to the first commandment? The American answer has been really largely a separation of church and state, and the problem is that the definition of that has so changed over time that some of the issues which are raised by increasing pluralism in our culture can't be very well answered. And so you have issues like this coming up, and there comes the question, is this the proper thing for the church for the civil magistrate to, in this case, in many ways you could say, endorse this plurality? Another example is school prayer, or prayer at public functions more generally. There's even a push some time ago to amend the Constitution to allow school prayer. And so the immediate reaction would be, oh, that would be something good. You know, we want to have prayer in public places and so forth. But if you think about how it's written, it's not endorsing Christian Trinitarian prayer. It's just endorsing prayer in school. So, in fact, it's sponsored by a Mormon. And that should give you an idea of the breadth in which this could be applied. And so I'm not raising these issues to say that, okay, I'm going to settle all these today, but just to say that first and second commandment related issues do come up. We don't really think of them in those terms, but that's the question. Can the state really be neutral with respect to religion? Or is there automatically some sort of endorsement or condemnation one way or the other of various religions? I'd also point out that our society has changed quite a bit over its time. In my parents' and grandparents' generations, there were laws against blasphemy which were enforced. you didn't blaspheme the name of God in public and get away with it, at least not on a large scale. I mean, there certainly would have been instances, but I'm just pointing out that there were laws like that. And even when I was growing up in Texas, the so-called blue laws were still enforced. There were laws against, anyone from Texas knows what they're, there are blue laws in different states, but there are laws against buying and selling certain things on the Sabbath. And so I'm just pointing out that although it may seem like this has no relevance, we may tend to think of the civil magistrate only having to do with, you know, the second table of the law, murder and theft and other areas. Yet it has been true historically in the United States, and that the first table issues have come up, and they're still issues, whether they're addressed properly or not. So I was just trying to give you some orientation. If I just started talking about this, it may sound rather abstract, like, you know, what does this have to do with us? Obviously, we don't have Asherah poles around, so, you know, why should we ask President Clinton to deal with them? But if you think in the context of the application of the law, I think you'll see there are issues. And so I'd like to think a little bit, only a little bit together, because I also want to look at chapter 16, but about some of the ways that this can be addressed from a biblical point of view. My basic statement would be that the nations of the earth are obligated to covenant together to be the Lord's. That as this is given here in 2 Chronicles 15 as really a renewal of an earlier covenant commitment, so the obligation in our day is for nations to covenant together to be Christians. I have one in my pocket. Is it on? Let's see, is this little light flashing? Yes, no. It's working. Thank you. This is a fake. There we go. Yeah. So the basic statement is that nations are obliged to serve Christ, that rulers are obliged to submit themselves to Christ. And the details of how that would then work out after that are worth a lot of discussion, but surely I can beg off going into details at this point. Let me point out, first of all, that the idea of some sort of a religious neutrality on the part of the civil magistrate, at least in terms of the as a constituted nation, is a novel idea. That is, in the history of the world, up until the time, really, of the, not the immediate founding, but after the founding of the U.S., this idea of neutrality was considered to be impossible. And so the civil magistrate would automatically, of course, seek to work within the framework of his own beliefs. There were certainly groups, even in church history at other times, who argued for some sort of a toleration, but they tended to be the heretical groups, like the Socinians, the forerunners of today's Unitarians at the time of the early Reformation, argued for something like that. And this is, of course, reflected in the Westminster Standards. I mentioned last week that this passage in 2 Chronicles 15 about the covenant and the actions that Asa took is cited by the Westminster Standards, both the Confession and Catechisms, as proof texts for what they were stating is the obligation of rulers today. And I thought I would read just one paragraph. This is from the Westminster Confession, chapter 20, which is on Christian liberty and liberty of conscience. Now, that may not sound like an area where this would be relevant, but with the agitation at the time of the Reformation, some of the fringe groups arguing for a very broad liberty of conscience, they were arguing for basically that the civil magistrate should just let everyone do what is right in their own eyes in terms of their belief. And there are nuances in the position, but basically they said there are some practices which the magistrate cannot allow. Let me read this. They write well, but they don't write the way we do, so you have to listen carefully. And because the powers which God hath ordained and the liberty which Christ hath purchased are not intended by God to destroy, but mutually to uphold and preserve one another, they who, upon pretense of Christian liberty, shall oppose any lawful power or the lawful exercise of it, whether it be civil or ecclesiastical, resist the ordinance of God. And for their publishing of such opinions, or maintaining of such practices as are contrary to the light of nature or to the known principles of Christianity, whether concerning faith, worship, or conversation, or to the power of godliness, or such erroneous opinions or practices as either in their own nature or in the manner of publishing or maintaining them are destructive to the external peace and order which Christ hath established in the church, they may lawfully be called to account and proceeded against by the censures of the church and by the power of the civil magistrate. That's especially that last part that I think is relevant to the discussion. That is, the civil magistrate, as we discussed before, doesn't directly deal with the thoughts of men, even though they may try to. That's not really their realm. But the point that was made here about the publishing of opinions and the holding of them, which is destructive to the external peace and order of which Christ hath established in the church, that external disruption is something that the civil magistrate and the church should be concerned with. And so that's, they're in a sense drawing the line there and saying the civil magistrate does have a responsibility to forbid wide-scale disruption of the public peace by this sort of broad toleration which was being argued for in their day. Now, that's only one example. There are other references, as I said, later in the Confession and in the Catechisms. But the question then comes, well, how can they say that? I mean, Asa was Asa. He's way back in the Old Testament. What does that have to do with us today? What's the biblical basis for applying passages like this? Well, it's an interesting topic, and I'll only give you a little bit about it, but let's turn to Psalm 2. If you only have a brief time to discuss the issue, Psalm 2 is an excellent place to start. I put up some other references on the board to expand only a little bit on the topic, but Psalm 2 is, I hope, a familiar one, as the psalm starts with the question, "Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us." The response then of the Lord is given in verses 4 through 6. "He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance, and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all those who put their trust in him." Now, this psalm directly addresses the situation of nations raging against God. And of course, you'll remember, as it was applied in the Gospels and in the book of Acts, especially in the book of Acts, to even the kings conspiring against the Messiah at his crucifixion, that is, Herod and Pontius Pilate conspiring together. They had been separated before, but they were united in this action. So this psalm goes even beyond that to describe all the actions in which the nations of the earth rebel against the Lord Christ. And it calls them to account. And that's especially important to notice here. It calls them to account in terms of submissiveness to his rule. Christ has the authority to rule. It says in verse 8, "Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession." And so at the Great Commission, right, he says, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and in earth." That's really an allusion, I think, at least indirectly, to this statement that all the nations are given to you. And so the question comes then, in what capacity should the rulers respond to the lordship of Christ? Is this merely a call to personal devotion to Christ? That is, should we call all rulers to become Christians just the way we call everyone else to become a Christian? Well, of course you should. I mean, that certainly shouldn't be excluded. That should be the first step, that the ruler should submit as an individual. But, of course, the tendency, especially in the American tradition, is to resist any application of that to the way the king rules. That is, he has his private devotions, but any application of that to a broader sphere is heretical from the American political point of view, at least it is now. And so the question is asked, are they really being asked to submit as individuals or in their capacity as rulers? And there's a very simple way to answer that question, and that is ask, in what capacity did they rebel against him? Did they rebel against him in verses 1 and 2 and 3 in their individual capacity or in their capacity as rulers? And the answer is obvious enough. They were rebelling against him as rulers and using their civil power to oppose him. And the call is, instead of that, a rebellion against Christ, to submit themselves to him. Submit themselves to him as rulers, and the call is for nations to submit themselves to him. The statement in verse 12, rather, that they should kiss the Son, is drawn from the practice of one lesser ruler submitting to a higher ruler. A conquered king submitting to a conquering king. The kiss would be the kiss of submission, of allegiance, and say, "You are my Lord, I will serve you and be faithful to you." And so, of course, the call is that the civil magistrates, as rulers, would submit themselves to Christ in that way, that they would make a covenant, in other words, although the language isn't really brought out here, that they would swear allegiance to him. Now, as I said, that is the general argument. The immediate objection, which would be raised especially in dispensationalist circles, would be that this psalm is only relevant to the millennial kingdom. That is, the view of a premillennial kingdom where Christ returns and sets up a literal kingdom in earth out of Jerusalem and rules over the nations. They would say that's the time in which this is fulfilled. And my answer to that would be all of our discussion earlier on, that Christ is now sitting on the throne of David. Christ is now the inheritor, if you will, of the promises given to David, the ruling over all the nations and so forth. And understanding that Christ is now ruling on the throne of David certainly implies that as the nations are given to Christ, it's something which is to occur now in history as they submit themselves to him. Although certainly not in a full and complete way until the last day. Now, as I said, I only want to talk about it a little bit. That's not very easy, but I just want to give the general answer that I think the correct framework for understanding and applying the passages in the Old Testament, the Book of Chronicles, is in terms of the rule of Christ. These men were types of Christ. They weren't very good types, as we'll see, of Asa later on. I mean, Asa didn't trust in the Lord. They weren't completely faithful. And yet, insofar as they ruled faithfully, they showed Christ, whose zeal was such that he said, "His zeal for your house has consumed me." And then the application would be rulers then can follow the model that we've been reading about, obviously with some application still to be made in terms of thinking through circumstances. Rulers can still follow that model as they follow the anti-type, Christ, of whom these people were only pictures. As I said, there are other references which we could look at. There are interesting verses in Jeremiah 50 and Isaiah 19 which use the language of covenanting in a prophetic sense, that the nations will covenant to be the Lord's. And they're very interesting passages to look at. Egypt and Assyria, the main opponents of Israel, are called my people by God in a prophetic sense. It's an amazing passage. And they will swear by the name of the Lord and agree to be his. And there are other passages in Isaiah which were often cited, especially in arguments such as given here in the time of the Reformation, that the prophecies that the rulers would be as nursing fathers and nursing mothers to the church, that they would have the good of God's people at the center of their concern. But let me emphasize again that whatever the details are, and obviously in our day we don't have a ruler or rulers who are particularly oriented toward kissing the Son and submitting to Him. And so exactly the way you apply these verses in our day is more difficult.